Many panelists have mentioned, and we hear frequently, that one of the justifications for this is that it will reduce the use of pesticides. And in fact, pesticide poisoning is a major, major public health threat throughout the world, this country included, but certainly in the developing world. So my question is, quite apart from genetic engineering technologies, would CropLife International be willing to commit tonight to say that their member companies should no longer produce Class 1A, 1B, and Class 2 pesticides, which are responsible for the vast majority of poisonings throughout the world, simply stop producing, selling, and pulling them back, which would do more to end and to certainly to reduce the pesticide poisoning that has been mentioned as a justification here.
Thank you for that question. I think it's the issue of pesticide poisoning is one that is a lot of concern to us and one that we have been trying to address for a number of years, and I'll come to that in a moment. First of all, it's important to realize the complexity of that issue, particularly in developing countries. All complex solution, there's usually one very simple and wrong solution. So if you allow me to explain a little bit and elaborate a little bit on the complexity of that particular issue. But if you want to have a short answer, is that there's answers there is in two forms. One is strengthening regulatory regimes into developing countries, and this is something that CropLife International, through our network of association, have been collaborated with FAO and with the local government in putting in place solid regulatory frameworks. The second answer to that is proper stewardship. And you probably know, and I'm sure your organization is aware, that since 1991 now, when the organization was called GCPF, we have initiated safe use programs all around the world, starting with pilot programs in Thailand, Guatemala, and Kenya, and expanding these programs into the rest of developing countries. This being said, we need to do more, and we actually have engaged with the dialogue and would like to have more of a dialogue with the Pesticide Action Network and other organizations to try to see what other measures we can take. In terms of the... Thank you. At least I can go home and say it was a successful night. But we will look into that, that particular matter, and invite, the Pesticide Action Network and Barbara Dinham in particular to discuss that. Thank you.
Is Andrew Geller at the mic?
David, I'm sorry that this is for you too. And I'll shorten the question that was up there. Given the issue of genetic drift that George Naylor brought up, and independent non-governmental organization studies and research about increased use of pesticides, Percy Smizer here could talk about that in Saskatchewan with canola, and lower, not higher, yields of transgenic crops. Can you still stand behind your statement in your first segment that there is no cause for concern about biotech agricultural crops?
Yes.
Trying to remember your question exactly. Okay. The question of genetic or pollen drift. Two parts to that. One, is there an environmental risk? Is there a health and safety risk? That we can address and do address through the regulatory system. We can, once we have determined that the product is safe, that it creates no environmental risk, that it creates no health and safety risk, then the pollen drift no longer becomes a health and safety concern. All right. Now, the next part of that is there some other reason to be concerned about pollen drift? Mr. Naylor's concern was that it impacted his organic production. Well, that's not a health and safety issue. That's not an environmental issue. That's a marketing issue. That's a question of whether this farmer is going to realize the full value of his crop. It's not a question of whether his crop is any less safe. It's a question of whether he gets the premium for growing an organic crop. So do I stand by my statement that it's safe? Yes, I stand by my statement that if it's been through our regulatory system, that it's safe.
About whether or not you thought it was safe, it was whether or not you thought there was any cause for concern.
Well, I'm
quoting you earlier.
Did I say actually no
yes.
cause for concern?
Yes, I'm a journalist. I get quotes very...
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly believe you. In that case, let me say that the context for saying no cause for concern was the health and safety and environmental risk context, not the commercial context. Is there a commercial issue? Yes, obviously there's a commercial issue there.
Okay, let me ask Steve Wirtz, please, to come to the microphone. Steve Wirtz, if you're still here, and Angus Wright. And while we're waiting for that, let me pose a devil's advocate question here, speaking as another journalist, to the critics of genetically modified foods. I was listening today to the Forum program on KQED, and Peter Pringle, British journalist, has a book out now called Food Incorporated, in which he has looked at the entire industry of GE food and at the critics. And Anuradha Mittal was on that program as well. And Mr. Pringle made a point, I believe, that that there's a lot of possible benefits to come out of genetically modified food, as well as a lot of problems. And in his view, the difficulty was, is there a way that the technology could be properly regulated by government agencies? So let me put the question to the three critics here. Would you completely rule out the possibility of genetically modified crops ever playing a role in agriculture and therefore hunger issues around the world if you yourselves could be the ones designing the regulatory process and overseeing the regulatory process? Would you shut the door entirely in a sort of a Luddite position, or do you believe that the problem is one that could be fixed with intelligent and empathetic regulation? Anuradha Mittal.
Well, I think the rationale that's been presented to us that we need this technology to feed the third world, we would need, first of all, a real reason as to why we need this technology, because we do not need this technology to feed the third world. Second would be we would need to follow precautionary principle, and we would need to have real evidence that it is really safe. And the problem, as we have seen with the revolving door policy, we have seen our regulatory agencies not doing their jobs. That evidence is not about to come in, because we are being told right now that it is safe, that there is no need for concern around environment and around health concerns. So given that factor, that we do not have precautionary principle, it will not be acceptable. Thirdly, till we can ensure that people have, that we go through a real public debate and discussion is allowed, that if we really want this technology, we do live in democracies. We cannot allow a handful of people to make those decisions for us. Even in this country, this food got into our market shelves without a public debate. So we would need a public debate, and if the people really want this technology, and I think if a decent rationale is indeed presented, we would see where it goes with that. So till that happens, we're not about to budge on it. At least I'm not.
Mm-hmm. And Sylvia Ribeiro, you are the regulator. You are the regulator. You get to run it. Would you allow it?
Well, I wouldn't like to be a regulator for anyone, in the sense that I think that one of the main things that has been that has been alienated from all of us is our real, the real control of our lives in almost anything and almost all aspects. And I couldn't be a regulator for any other people, rather than try to recuperate the real empowerment of local communities to decide which kind of food, which kind of agriculture, which kind of industries they would like to have. Having said that, I have to say that genetic engineering in particular, I think is a technology that is so uncertain, that there are so many things that are unknown, the consequences about genetic engineering, that I think preliminary that this is a technology that should completely disappear. That's my view on the issue. This is because it's a technology which is completely artificial, that is crossing realms that could never have been crossed, and that would never cross in reality, and that is completely unaware of the long-term effects and also the effects on not only the biodiversity in the environment, but also the diversity within the genome and the interactions in the genomes and the genomes with others. So I think this is a technology that should be banned.
And Aminu Kanute, same question.
The African countries have come up with a model law on biotechnology. And that model law, as it stands now, has all the provisions that would allow what the farmer was talking about, which is, in case of liability, allowing the one whose products have contaminated the other one to pay for that. The same model law also has the possibility for us, when we are not happy with something, to have a class action. The same model law says that both for import and export there should be prior consent of the recipient country of the type of food that is coming in or that is being exported. That model law also provides for mandatory labeling. So here are some specific aspects that we have been asking for, which unfortunately are being undermined by the pro-GM lobby. They are now coming up and saying, we need to develop an alternative to the African model law. While it is this law, this model, that we think really takes into account all the concerns that are being raised both by the farmers, consumers, governments, small-scale farmers, and so on. So what we are saying here is we are in a market, and market, when they are deficient, when they are not effective, you need to come up with regulations. And this model law, which is now being undermined, is the one that we would like to see being enacted instead of it being undermined by the pro-GM lobby.
Thank you very much. Peter? We're going to have a couple more questions, but first an announcement from one of our hosts.
Good evening. My name is Peter Rossett from Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. I would like to say how appreciative we are of the Crest Theater and the Crest Theater management and Sid, who is here tonight, that they have been willing to take what is a considerable risk for them in allowing this event to take place, given the circumstances in Sacramento. And I'd like to have a big hand for the Crest Theater and their management. The co-hosts this evening are Food First and the Pesticide Action Network, and we want to thank all of you and especially all of our speakers for coming to our house tonight, because in a sense the Crest Theater tonight is our house, so thank you. And this is a difficult one, a difficult issue to raise, but we're going to have to ask on behalf of Food First and the Pesticide Action Network and CREST, in terms of our house, for a particular kind of respect this evening, which is, number one, to pick up any trash that's on the ground when you go up and go out and put it in the proper receptacle, but more so because the CREST Theater has basically, in taking the risk of having a controversial event, essentially staked their reputation on this being a peaceful event. And I know everybody here came tonight for a peaceful dialogue, to hear all of the different points of view, and to be able to make our own informed decisions. When we go out of the theater, you will notice some police presence outside. But this is a serious issue, because it's our house, and we've taken responsibility for our house, which includes our front porch. The police presence has fluctuated up and down. It's not as strong now as it was before, and the CREST Theater, together with us, have been negotiating a bit with the police for the possibility of a very peaceful and respectful departure from the theater. We really owe a big debt of gratitude to the CREST Theater, and I would really ask everybody, if possible, to agree to the essentially what we have agreed to with the folks who are outside, the law enforcement officials, which is that they would like people to not hang around in front of the theater when we go out, and we would also like people not to hang around, because it's a commitment we've made to the theater, but rather to very peacefully and calmly disperse on to whatever your next destination may be. Now, we're on K Street, and the principal concern, apparently, that the police have is that we not hang around on K Street very long. They would just like us to go to either one of the corners, half a block in either direction, and disperse to wherever we're going along the side streets. And we have said that we would ask you, as a measure of respect to the CREST Theater and to this being our house tonight and to this being a peaceful dialogue, a kind of dialogue actually we would like to see take place much more. Probably there wouldn't be a need for protest if it did. A kind of dialogue we would actually like to have seen take place inside the convention center with the ministers in the audience. But as a measure, then, of respect for Food First and PAN, and especially for the CREST Theater, we do ask that folks very quietly and calmly exit from this particular block and go off on the side streets, and we wish everybody a wonderful evening afterwards, wherever you choose your final destination or next destination to be. So thanks. Thank you to our guests. Thank you to the CREST Theater, and thanks to everybody. Thank you.
I think we have time for one more question, if it's not too much of an anticlimax after that. And Mr. Steve Wirtz, are you at the mic? Steve Wirtz, please. You get the last question, and then everyone will have a chance to comment on this up and down the line, and then we'll call it a night.
Well, I appreciate being here tonight listening to a debate, and I appreciate having a chance to ask a question. I'm sure there's many more to ask. I've been around long enough, unfortunately, to have heard about the Green Revolution in the 50s and at a time when I was studying malnutrition. And unfortunately, today I come to you, as someone else already said, that there are 25,000 young children under five that die each day in the world from malnutrition and hunger and simple diseases that are solved very simply if we had a better distribution system. The Green Revolution was sold as the modern solution of science solving problems, and unfortunately it was sold in large part by scientists. I'm a scientist, and I feel my question is, how do we hold scientists and politicians responsible for making unrealistic and undocumented claims for such things that did not pan out the way they were intended?
So, how do we hold scientists and politicians accountable for decisions like biotechnology? We will start down at the end and carry on this way.
Okay, well, it's going to be difficult to conclude on that question. I think when you say the results did not pan out the way it was supposed to be, That's not exactly true. I think what we did see in terms of the Green Revolution is in the 60s and 70s and the 80s, considerable increase in yield and considerable reduction in poverty. And I believe, you know, despite what Anuradha might say, I think including in India. What I think we did see is after that, in the 90s, it's a growing population, etc., and we see that no longer the needs are being met. And resolving the complex issue of poverty reduction is a very complex one. And it's, I mean, I would agree with that. I think technology is definitely not part of the solution. But trying to address the issue of the distribution systems has failed as well. And what I believe the consensus is from what I've read and I've, you know, talked to several people as well, is that we need to increase the purchasing power, the disposable income of the people, of the rural poor, of the people in the rural community, so that they have a higher disposable income. And that can be done by, among other things, also by increasing yield and technology, and particularly gene technology, can be a solution, a part of that solution, I think, in increasing, you know, the revenues and the status of these people into the rural communities, as it has done, indeed, in the early phases of the rural revolution. And what we need now is a second wave of green revolution in that area.
Let me quickly, for our radio listeners, just rephrase this quickly. The question we're dealing with at the end here is the biotech revolution a replay of the Green Revolution, and is that a good thing or a bad thing? And how do you hold scientists and politicians responsible for those kinds of big decisions?
The by some estimates, the Green Revolution saved 1 billion lives. If that's a failure, then I don't know how we're going to ever make progress on these issues. Science and technology don't stand still. They continue to evolve. We continue to learn. And we need to learn the lessons of the Green Revolution and the people it didn't help. It passed Africa by. It saved 1 billion lives, but there are still 800 million people that are chronically hungry today. There's more to do. There's always more to do. And we need every tool we can get. Should people be held responsible for that, for making claims like that? I think that's for public opinion to decide. How do you hold somebody responsible for saving 1 billion lives, but he didn't save the other 800 million?
Thank you very much. Amadou Kanute.
I will answer both as a consumer and as a citizen. As a consumer, I will decide not to buy the product and vote the product out of the market. And then there, I'm punishing the industry, the corporation, and the scientists who put the product on the market, who developed it, who did the research and development, and marketed it. As a citizen, I would have the same reaction, the same behavior than with the product. Politicians, they come to us with plans, with programs, and they are elected on that ground. When a politician makes a mistake, and the mistake has far-reaching consequences, the public has to make the decision on whether or not we want to get them out of the market, out of the decision-making position in which we elected them earlier on.
Thank you very much. Silvia Ribeiro.
Yeah. I don't think that the biotechnology or genetic engineering is continuing the Green Revolution. In a way, it is completely following the Green Revolution because they are the same companies. It's exactly the same companies. All the companies I mentioned before is the same agrochemical companies that brought us the Green Revolution. And now they're selling transgenics saying that they will use less of their own agrochemicals. It's just to connect this with one thing that was said before. In fact, pharmaceutical, agrochemical, and seeds companies, and more of the same the whole time. And they are the same companies that brought us the patent system all over the world through the imposition of the World Trade Organization, through the Uruguay Round, through the TRIPS agreement, the trade-related intellectual property agreements. And they are the same companies, the pharmaceutical companies that then got merged with agrochemical and seed companies. So they are the same companies, they have the same idea, and in that sense, there is a continuation. It's not, I should say that the biotech, or not the biotech, the genetic engineering revolution is very different, because the Green Revolution was working with hybrids that could have some kind of regulation through the environment. The transgenics are, so to say, cheating the environment. The nature doesn't know how to handle this. So this is much more hazardous than the Green Revolution. But the companies are the same. It is a continuation in the same way. And in fact, the Green Revolution has not, I don't know how is the criteria about saying that it saved lives, but for sure it has displaced millions and millions of farmers from the lands, and this has caused much more disease and hunger than any technological fix. So I couldn't let the decision to connect with the politicians and science, I couldn't let the decision on any of these aspects in our life to the scientists as they are today. I think that one main thing we have to do is to recuperate the social orientation of science, which is totally, totally apart from society. Science today is working for corporations, 90%.
Thank you very much. We have two left, and then we're going to have to scoot out of here. Martina McLaughlin, please.
Well, I'm neither a politician nor an industrial scientist. I'm a mere academic, and believe me, if you're in academia, it's not for the money. You're there because you love the science and what it can do, and I passionately believe that this technology can be used with other technologies that are specific to local regions to improve the quality of life, the quality of the environment for people in these areas. And I think it is a crime against humanity for any of us to deprive people of whatever means is going to help them to improve their quality of life in a sustainable manner.
Thank you very much. And Anuradha Mittal.
I disagree with some of my colleagues here, but first of all, I want to thank them and say thank you very much for joining us here tonight. Okay, now this is where I disagree. In terms of Green Revolution, at the height of the Green Revolution, food production increased by 17%. But if you remove China from the picture, hunger also increased around the world by 19%. And that's because China went through land reform and other things. So as long as you do not deal with that, any technological fix is not going to solve the problem of hunger. And as Sylvia has pointed out, you see more destruction of livelihoods. And it's not surprising in my country, India, that farmers have been consuming pesticides to take their own lives, because we don't have markets. The crops are standing there, and they have huge, big debts, and when faced with a dead end, some opt for death. In terms of how to make politicians and scientists responsible, I would agree with Amadou in terms of politicians. Vote them out of office if they do not represent what I believe in. But when it comes to scientists, I would say before we hold them responsible, we have to free them from corporate influence. Our California state universities... As long as state universities, for example, UC Berkeley, getting only 30% of its funding from state, as long as they're financially strapped, the research agendas will be determined by Novartis, by Monsanto, who are funding UC Berkeley. So before we move into the arena of holding them, you know, accountable, we have to ensure that our research budgets, instead of creating a police state, actually go into our education system.
Thank you all very much. Thanks to all of our panels. to our panelists.
On behalf of everyone in this audience, I know it's not been an easy thing to do. I want to first of all ask everyone to give a big round of applause for Mark, our moderator. You are not an easy audience.
Thank you very much. I'll have a quick thank you for our panelists, Anuradha Mittal, Martina McLaughlin, Sylvia Ribeiro, Christian Pershoren, David Hegwood, Amadou Kanute. This has been the debate on agriculture, hunger, and biotechnology from here at the Crest Theater in Sacramento, California on June 23. Thank you all for coming. Travel safely, and good night.